people want the decisive action on climate. And to kick that to your kids and their kids to solve is just grossly irresponsible. It's intergenerational theft. The same thinking on coal. You know, I had a press secretary once who ended up Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, who thought coal was good for humanity. Then Morrison turned up in Parliament with a lump of coal. Just shows you how demented they really are, doesn't it?
One for Mum, one for Dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and the country is in the middle of another crippling drought, specifically in New South Wales and Queensland. And while scientists don't like to attribute one single weather event to climate change, they do agree that droughts are going to become more frequent and more severe with global warming.
Tonight, a bushfire emergency at Bundeena. Hundreds evacuated.
You just can't overstate the impact that the drought's having, not just on our farmers, but also the elevated fire risk.
We had the driest winter on record last year. We've had the hottest summer the year before on
record. One climate change scientist is now warning we better get used to bushfires happening earlier and the fire season lasting longer.
So climate change is very much the driving force between many extreme weather events here in Australia.
And it really hurts to see our leaders not mention the word climate change.
But Australia's politicians seem to be in a state of paralysis about what to do about climate change. The argument about taking some action, any action, has led to the unseating of at least five prime ministers. Our latest Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, still the Prime Minister at the time of recording, is notable for bringing a lump of coal into Parliament with him and for most recently dumping the government's only climate change policy, the National Energy Guarantee, otherwise known as the NEG.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The Treasurer knows the rule.
The reality is, I don't really give a rat's whether it's man-made or not.
The climate change science is far from settled.
Climate change is real, it is affecting us now, and it is having a particularly severe impact on Australia.
The role of CO2 is not nearly as clear as the climate catastrophists would suggest.
Number one priority is very, very simple. It is to reduce power prices.
These politicians are grossly out of step with what the Australian public want, according to the benchmark survey Climate of the Nation. Climate of the Nation 2018 shows that 73% of the community is concerned about climate change. That's a five-year high, and it's up from just 66% last year. Respondents also rated profiteering from power companies as the number one reason why electricity prices are so high, followed by privatisation and federal government inaction. When it comes to coal-fired power, a majority of people want to see coal-fired power end within the next 20 years, and more Australians support a moratorium on new coal mines than oppose it. The annual Climate of the Nation report is the longest-running benchmark survey of Australian attitudes on climate change. And this year is the first time the Australia Institute has produced the report. We took it over from the Climate Institute, which ran it for the last decade, and we'd like to really thank the Climate Institute for all their work over those many years. Dr. John Hewson is a professor at the Australian National University's Crawford School of Public Policy. He's former leader of the Liberal Party and also former member for Wentworth. And we invited Dr. Hewson to launch Climate of the Nation in Parliament House this week. Dr. Hewson also spoke at our regular Politics in the Pub event later that evening, and he was joined by the Australia Institute's Executive Director, Ben Oquist.
John, having launched Climate of the Nation today, and obviously across the report, and seen how so much of the Australian population wants action on climate change, wants more investment in renewables, wants deeper emissions cuts, wants action on coal industry, wants a phase out of our coal-fired power stations. Such overwhelming findings. What's going wrong?
I think everyone in the government has got a tin ear. They're not paying attention to the reality of the electorate's views. I mean, every time you speak to a politician these days, they'll tell you how they know their voter. You know, they know their seat, they know their electorate, they know their constituency. Well, we've seen some recent evidence where they clearly don't know. I mean, a good example is the same-sex marriage postal vote, where the turnout was much, much bigger than they imagined. In fact, some of the Conservatives led by Abbott thought that having a postal survey would probably kill it, because young people wouldn't be able to find a post office, never written a letter, whatever. And actually, the turnout was phenomenal. And here we have climate change as an issue where overwhelmingly the electorate has led the government. I mean, way out in front. We have just at the basic level more household solar panels on roofs per capita than any other country in the world. The electorate has moved for whatever reason very quickly and can't understand why government can't sort themselves out. And as Ben said, I've been involved in this issue since the early 90s. In the package that I took to the 93 election, we had a very substantive environment policy, which I'm sure nobody read. they got distracted on the GST or something else, but, it called for a 20% cut in emissions by the year 2000 off a 1990 base. And today we're waiting for the explanation for a 5% cut in emissions by 2020 off a 2000 base. And, of course, we have the Paris commitments of 26 to 28% reduction in emissions by 2030, which is about half what it should be if we want to get to net zero emissions by 2050. But even so, we have no idea how the government would actually take us down that pathway, that transition to 2030. And today, of course, they took an even further step backwards by canning the NEG, even though that was, in the end, the fourth best solution. My God. As an economist, you know, we had a chance to have an emissions trading scheme several times. That went by the boards, various attempts by both sides, I guess, and politics on that. Then an emissions intensity scheme, and then the Finkel recommendation for a clean energy target. Then finally, let's go for the fourth best, the NEG. And you know, can you believe it? Turnbull actually got party room support for the NEG on two occasions. Overwhelming stakeholder support right across the power industry, right across the business community, broadly across civil society. You know, overwhelming evidence that this is what people wanted to see. Let's get on with it. And today they decide to put the NEG on the back burner, not to pursue it. And in fact, they won't talk about emissions reduction anymore. Now, it's to me, that's just grossly irresponsible, apart from anything else. You know, it just leaves me cold to imagine that they are ignoring voters, and I think you'll see that now carry through to the election as a significant issue, the next federal election. It'll probably be an issue in the two state elections in November for Victoria and March for New South Wales. But most pressingly for poor old Morrison is that we have a by-election in my old seat of Wentworth on the 20th of October now, and I suspect that will be a big issue in that seat. And I was fascinated by how fickle the seat was, how easy it would change, and how there was a very significant, what we'd call a green element in that seat. But a strong independent running on climate and other issues, getting a protest vote against the Liberal Party, could win that seat. So I wouldn't be too complacent. The government could lose that seat and lose its majority in the parliament. The government's been playing with fire today by backing off what is overwhelmingly supported by a clear majority. 70%+ of the community want decisive action by government on climate change. They certainly want to see more renewables. I think that Lowy Institute survey recently, 84% of those polled wanted more renewables. You know, in some cases, they're happy to wear that even if it costs more, but it doesn't cost more anymore. Renewables are now cheaper than a new coal-fired power station. And although the Liberal Party flirts with the idea of developing a new coal-fired power station, the ultra-supercritical, you know, coal-fired power station that they've got in that they're building in Japan, which, by the way, I heard early on that some of our coal can't burn in that because it doesn't have the right fusion temperature, but we won't let those details get in the way. We could import coal for that purpose. Why not? You know, it's a nonsense argument. It won't get built. The financial community won't fund it. The insurance community recently has come out. AXA, for example, has said that they won't insure any new coal-fired power stations anywhere in the world. So go ahead and build it, you know. Just to meet the Paris objectives, about 70% of the known reserves could never be dug and burnt if we were to meet that Paris objective by 2050. So no new coal mines seems a pretty logical position to take. And so I'm fascinated at the debate about Adani, you know. And the nature of that debate has changed so many times as the justification has changed, you know. Originally, we're going to export our coal to India to deal with the poor who don't get access to electricity. Then we find out they're actually not going to sell the coal in India because they don't want it anymore. They're transitioning quite quickly towards renewables, so they're going to sell it to Bangladesh and Pakistan or somewhere at an inflated price. And then they can't get finance. 25 or 30 major banks won't finance it. Palaszczuk won an election by arguing against the Adani case, said she wouldn't sign off on the Northern Australian infrastructure facilities supporting the rail link. You know, I don't know whether you know much about Adani, but it's a couple of hundred kilometres inland on the other side of the Great Divide. You not only have to build the mine, you've got to get the coal over the Great Divide and a new rail link, and the coal would go out through Abbott Point, which would need to be expanded at the expense of the reef. So I can see a lot of boxes in there that you can't tick. Yet the debate persists. Nobody will come out and actually say at the political level, both sides, that this should not go ahead. The same thinking on coal. You know, I had a press secretary once who ended up Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, who thought coal was good for humanity. Mm-hmm. And then Morrison turned up in Parliament with a lump of coal. Mm-hmm. It just shows you how demented they really are, doesn't it?
John, why do you think the conservative side of politics... A journalist told me the other day I shouldn't call it the conservative side, I should call it the right side, because nothing much conservative about them.
Nothing much right either.
have good. Found it so difficult to tackle the climate change issue in Australia. Is there something unique about the right or conservatives in Australia that has made it so much more difficult here than in some other countries?
Well, it's interesting. We've lost a whole series of leaders, prime ministers, over the climate issue. I mean, Howard, really, one of the real reasons he lost was that he wasn't prepared to sign or ratify the Kyoto Protocol and made it easy for Rudd to say, I'll sign it. Like he said, I'll say sorry, when Howard said, no, I won't say sorry, and I'm not sorry. Those sort of positions, which became very stubborn positions, I think were fundamental to his demise. He not only lost his seat, but lost government. But Rudd himself didn't have a great success with climate. And he started with a great capacity. I met him a couple of times, and he had a very clear agenda. You know, he was going to ratify Kyoto, then he was going to have the Green Paper, the Garneau Report, the White Paper, go to the legislation, and if I can't get the legislation through the Parliament, I will dissolve both Houses of Parliament and I'll push it through. And I think if he had have done that in February 2010, if he had have stuck with that agenda, he would probably still be Prime Minister, heaven forbid. But I mean, I think he lost an opportunity, but it was the basis for him losing, Gillard replacing him, then Gillard changed their mind, of course, no government I lead to put a price on carbon. Then, of course, she put a price on carbon and missed the introduction of that. Julia announced that decision to reverse her pre-election commitment, I think in February of that year, but she didn't say anything more about it until July. I thought she might have tried to build the case, you know, link the science to the need for response, lay out the options, this is why we're doing what we're doing, why we're doing it, this is what we hope to achieve, this is why there's an imperative. She said nothing. So Abbott went all over the country making all sorts of outrageous claims, you know, about why Ella would close and women would become barren and your hair would fall out or whatever. He got away with any sort of argument, which was totally unquestioned by the Labor Party. And she finally announced the detail in June and put the wrong price on it. Put a fixed price of $23 when the European price was probably about $6. And, of course, that created its own problem. But Abbott then thinks he wins the election on the basis of his opposition to the carbon tax. So he comes in and he abolishes it. And then he didn't last. Turnbull came in with a great flourish. Everyone expected he'd do something substantive on climate. He didn't. So we had a succession of leaders that have lost their job. And that's the background, I think, to the question you've just asked about the Conservatives. Now, I don't like labels at all. I hear right and left and conservative, progressive. People ask me what I am. I hate putting a label on it. I mean, I guess I was, in that sense, a small L liberal in a large L liberal party. But I don't like those labels because I've, you know, read all the sources and the writers in all those areas and I pick what I liked. Most people are complex and they're not narrow in their thinking. Although some of the conservatives act as if this is a true conservative position to oppose the science, to oppose climate, and to now end up with a very socialist position trying to regulate the power companies. Very odd position for a conservative to hold. And I remember Howard gave a speech to the climate deniers group in London, which run by Nigel Lawson, who I've actually debated here in Australia on climate. I don't think he's extreme as some of the others that go under that banner as climate deniers or climate sceptics. But Howard made a speech there where he openly admitted he played short-term politics with climate. He said when it suited him, he would support decisive action on climate. And there were times where he looked at a renewable energy target or emissions trading schemes and so on. But when it didn't suit him politically, he opposed it. And then he made a most amazing statement as a representative of the so-called right, is that he thought in the end he remained, he said, an agnostic when it came to climate, and he preferred to rely on his instincts. Now, it's not a question of religion, it's a question of science. And the science is overwhelming. 97% of pure assessed climate scientists say it's an important, urgent issue to be dealt with. And, you know, as non-climate scientists, we should take their view, I reckon. It's an unusual thing for scientists to agree on anything, because the nature of science is you disagree. So it is a question of science. And then when it comes to Howard's instincts, well, I worked for him for 7 years as a chief advisor. Didn't like his instincts. When he worked for me, I certainly didn't like his instincts, one of which was to get rid of me. So, you know, it's about getting the most cost-effective and sensible reaction. And so if you were a true conservative today, if you were genuinely conservative, if you believe, as they would claim to do, in avoiding change, unnecessary change, let's say, always in favour of smaller government, less regulation, relying wherever possible on market processes and market forces. If you're a true conservative, you'd have an emissions trading scheme. You put a price on carbon and you get out of the way and let it happen. And when you don't do that and you still want to meet some sort of objectives, you end up doing silly things like we'll regulate the power companies or we'll have a royal commission into the power companies. People don't like power companies because they don't like banks. We'll have another royal commission. Not deal with the issue. So the conservative position, I think, is indefensible as they sell it as a conservative position. And it's not conservative. Well, it's very socialist. It's very, left. Not right.
Well, this is kind of leading to my next question. You've started to answer it, I think. John, what would you do if you were Prime Minister today?
I mean, apart from firing the entire cabinet and starting again. Look, I think that the electorate is looking, as that survey today shows, the electorate's looking for leadership. And they are prepared, I think, to wear the truth. And if somebody were prepared to stand up and lead on this issue, okay, set out what needs to be done, what sort of transition we're going to have to make in order to get to the sort of Paris objectives by 2030, the pluses and minuses, be quite open about potential winners and losers, facilitating transitions, maybe including some financial support, including some training support. There's a lot that a government could do by setting a clear sense of direction and backing it up with the relevant policy initiatives. And, you know, I used to say in the Turnbull days that Malcolm needed to do what people expected him to do. They wanted him to lead. He came in with enormous expectations. As I said many times, if he'd actually said, I am going to lead on this issue, I'm going to set a clear-cut agenda and to take you with me. I'm going to explain to you the nature of the problem, I'm going to set out the options for dealing with it, I'm going to pick an option, I'm going to fight for it, day in, day out. Not only would the electorate have been enormously surprised that he actually delivered what he said, but they would have cut him a lot of slack. And the tragedy from my point of view is, I go back to what I said in the early 90s, I mean, if we'd moved to an emissions trading scheme with those sort of objectives over the 1990s, just imagine where we'd be today. How many more billions of dollars worth of investment, hundreds probably of thousands of jobs, certainly a significantly stronger economic growth performance, all of which has been squandered by short-term politics. We've lost those opportunities. In this country, we have an abundance of wind and solar resource. We have the technology, particularly solar thermal type technologies, but with storage, solar PV and wind with storage. We have all that capacity in this country. We could have led the world for the last 25 or 30 years. Now, if you can't sell an argument like that, you shouldn't be in politics. So I think it's worth taking the electorate with you. And that's what I think they're looking for right now. But it's getting harder and harder. The arteries have hardened on these positions. Nobody wants to admit something different. They don't want to admit they made a mistake. I mean, by Morrison today saying we're going to ditch the NEG, he's sort of implicitly admitting that the big kerfuffle we just had about leadership was because of energy policy. It had nothing to do with energy policy. It was all about revenge, driven by Tony Abbott, and ego, driven by Dutton. And Tony convinced Dutton that, you know, mate, you could be Prime Minister, right? And Dutton said, yeah, that's a good idea. I believe in myself, you know, like way out of his depth. But Tony's strategy was clear. He wanted to not only bring down Malcolm, he wanted to put Dutton up as a bit of a, you know, stalking horse, a Trojan horse, knowing full well that once he was in Button's cabinet and Dutton wasn't performing, as you've already seen, he isn't performing. Oh, my God, I'll have to stand again, he would have said. You know, I'll get the job back. Now, that's what I think we've had to endure. It had nothing to do with energy policy. And for Morrison to come out and say that, oh, well, we've got to ditch the NEG, why? You've got a handful of dissidents, insurgents in the party, call them out. Question their pre-selection. I would have said that the party should, in the case of Abbott, as one of the insurgents, think about pulling his pre-selection. And as far as Dutton's concerned, make him accountable for his role as a Minister of Immigration, have an independent review of his conduct of that portfolio, and refer him to the High Court about his eligibility. That's not a political issue, that's a constitutional issue. You could clean that place up pretty quickly. And that's what I think you should be doing. And I'm surprised that Morrison's giving a very clear statement of being quite a wholesome individual, you know, a hardline right Christian religious sort of person. Well, he's compromising that by backing Dutton. He's compromising it by not leading when there is an overwhelming community support on an issue like climate. And, you know, he's sort of riding his own death knell in an electoral sense, because the electorate is not going to forget what happened. The one question they haven't been able to answer in the last few days in Parliament is, why did you replace Malcolm?
John, it seems, you've touched on it there, that the government is intent on making a virtue out of not tackling climate change or having much of an emissions policy. They seem to think that is a winner, and that the public equates that somehow with lower prices when the technology's changed. Do you think that the government can win the next election with a climate policy as it is? And do you see any hope anywhere on the conservative side of politics in Australia on climate policy?
Well, I don't think they can win an election with climate where it is, but they don't have a climate policy anymore. They've just ditched it. So they're going to go to the election ditching it. It'll depend a lot on what Shorten does. Shorten's obviously got a higher emissions reduction target, and they've been criticising him pretty heavily for that. And I think what Abbott would want to do, which has obviously influenced where they are, is to have a clear distinction between the government and the opposition, where the government has no climate policy, don't think emissions reductions are important, don't think we should be giving them priority, should be somehow getting prices down without telling you how we're going to do it. Just get the poor new minister for the energy out there saying, I'm going to bring down electricity prices. That's my job, I'm going to lower electricity prices. Don't know how many times he's said that in the last week or so. He never said how. Never said what he's going to do to achieve that outcome and at what cost. I think that is going to be a defining election issue. Shorten's not pure on it, though. I think he, in particular, has to clear himself up on coal. I mean, he hasn't been prepared to rule out Adani, which staggered me after what Palisades did in Queensland. And that's what I think Bill's got to do. Bill's got to spell out the detail of what he will do, have a pure position on this, not just try to sort of capitalise on the weaknesses, as he perceives, of the government, but go for the principle of the issue, outline in a detailed way the merits of what he wants to do. and that can't include coal.
Well, I'm going to throw it over to you, ask a couple of questions. I've got one right here to start with.
I wanted to know your view on the role of the media, because it seems to me that the media has really let Australians down, and in particular were dominated by the Rupert Murdoch press. Any views on that?
The big thing that's happened is the media itself has become politicised as well. There have increasingly been a number in the media and a number of outlets and so on that have seen themselves as players in the game. And they conspicuously played the game. They thought they could help determine the outcome. I mean, those 2GB shock jocks, Alan Jones and Ray Hadley, yes, I almost forget his name every time, for good reason. They saw themselves as running a really solid agenda in support of Abbott, return to the position, and dead set against Turnbull, whatever they did. And in the end, we see Jones taking credit for the fact that he actually rang back benches and told them how to vote. Now, while that is an issue, and it's a fact, I don't think they are anywhere near as important as they pretend to be. You know, I think the radio audience of Hadley and Jones is about 13%. I don't think that they have the effect that they think. I was doing a radio program with Ed Husic, for example, one of those members from the Labor Party recently, and we had that discussion. He said he'd never seen any effect of Alan Jones in his seat. So I think that there is an issue there that they exaggerate their significance. They want to be relevant. They want to be kingmakers. But quite frankly, you know, I think over time they'll be seen for what they are. And, you know, right now I notice that Hadley and Jones are saying reasonably nice things about Morrison. I wonder how long that will last, because Abbott's not going to give up his Monday appearances on their programs. You know, Abbott's got this transparent strategy, hasn't he? He does the Monday interview, and then in the news poll weeks, he pulls some sort of stunt on about Thursday in the midst of the polling to try and influence the outcome, you know. That, yeah, people don't realise that he used to work for me, and I don't want that to reflect on me at all. I had him there because I knew he would have an extreme hardline right view, which I could make him argue out with some people on the hardline left. And I might get better policy as a result. But disloyal? Yes. He was a constant channel to John Howard for everything that happened in my office. I had stories come out of my office before I'd done them. I remember once I wrote a letter in support of the gay Mardi Gras in Sydney. It's just a standard letter about the significance of the event. And before it was posted in those days, Howard was in my office yelling and screaming about how dare I, you know, back a group like that. Now, I wonder how you got that, John. You know, I live with that reality. But it wasn't always bad, because when I wanted to get a story out for a reason, I'd tell Abbott, he'd tell Howard, he'd go out in the media and say, oh, I don't know about that, I deny it. So you can use them.
Very good. Next question.
If there's a good independent candidate in Wentworth, with a good renewable energy policy, will you campaign on their behalf?
I might have to. You find them. You know, people have suggested you should go back, John. How stupid do I look, right? But I do think it's right for a good independent candidate, and there are some being rumoured. We'll see whether they emerge. But I have appeared in some of the campaign meetings. I did a couple of climate events in when Turnbull was running for the election last time in that seat, big Paddington Town Hall meetings. People were trying to get commitments out of Turnbull to net zero emissions or emissions reduction strategies, focus on renewables. We did have a nice meeting amongst ourselves. It never had any impact on him.
I know that you don't want to go back into politics, but would you consider establishing something that is Conservatives for Climate Change, so that it would actually give voice to people within the Liberal Party who do actually believe in climate change, rather than this ridiculous notion that we've got at the moment?
Yeah, there is a basic issue here as to whether some of those people want to be led. You know, they've got so concerned about their positions. Look, I'm surprised. You know, I look at the Liberal Party today and I say, OK, what's the succession plan? You know, who's going to come through as a leader, and it's probably largely true of the Labor Party too. You take out the top couple, get some quite good people lower down, but none of them are taking any political risks. None of them are prepared to make a stand. And I would have thought in the current environment there's some potential for some of those people to make a stand. And, you know, I'm surprised that Angus Taylor, for example, who's got the energy portfolio, given his background with Port Jackson Partners and some of the things he said about pricing carbon and other things in his past, that he might have actually seized this opportunity to sort of lead the sort of movement that you're talking about. But no, he spent his entire time saying how he's going to lower power prices without telling you how he's going to do it. And his job is to lower power prices. They don't take risks. You do need to take risks in politics. You need to stand for something and be prepared to defend that position. It's no longer really a contest of ideas. It's no longer really a contest of values. So I don't think climate is an ideological issue. And it's easy to bag it as an ideological issue and somebody's extreme green left juicing, you know, gone mad sort of stuff, which they say, but it's not ideological. It's science. Science tells us in a pretty clear-cut way. And most people aren't climate scientists. And yet, you know, part of the debate, particularly in the Abbott era, when he was trying to close down the renewable energy target, was some pretty vindictive attacks on scientists, death threats on some scientists for speaking out. It drove a lot of those people to be quiet, to not participate actively in the debate. I've often heard the argument in the Liberal Party, well, we don't need to do it today, or we won't do it until one of our trading partners moves. We won't do it until China and India start to adjust. Well, they're actually doing a hell of a lot more than we are, and they're doing a lot faster than we are. And you can't leave it to 2029 and then go and change things. You won't wake up on 2029 and try and fix it, because you're changing behaviour over a long period of time, you're changing the industrial base of the system over a long period of time. And so to hear that argument in the Liberal Party, let's wait to 2029 or 2049, it really gives me the shits, to be honest, to hear that sort of argument when it's grossly irresponsible and the next generation and the one after that and the one after that is going to have a much bigger task with a much greater pressure, and they start to see the consequences of not dealing with the issue. One of the things that comes out in this survey today was not just the overwhelming support, nearly three quarters of people want the decisive action on climate, but they quickly link it to the fact that there's a drought, that there's the crop productions are going down, food supplies falling into question, bushfires are becoming more intense, the reef is at greater risk. People understand the risks that are being taken. It's grossly irresponsible of government not to recognise the concern that people have about that. And to kick that to your kids and their kids to solve is just grossly irresponsible. It's intergenerational theft.
Please thank John Hewson. Our time is up.
That's been episode 28 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. It was recorded at the Live Politics in the Pub event in Canberra on Wednesday, the 12th of September 2018. The Climate of the Nation report is available free on our website at tai.org.au. There, you can also find previous episodes of our podcast. And if you're particularly interested in all things climate and energy, I would recommend episodes 24, 17, 16, 14, 7, and our Pocket Money episode on the Adani coal mine. Listen free to Follow the Money on your favourite podcast app. We're also available on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. And you can find Ben Oquist at Ben Oquist, OQUIST. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with additional editing by Lizzie Jack. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. And you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.